This is Femi Kuti, and you are listening to NYC Radio Live.
Hello, friends. How are you doing? Feeling good? I hope so. It's very important to feel good. You're listening to NYC Radio Live. David Ellenbogen here, your humble servant. And I got some great music from Aaron Schrag and Ben Monder. And we get to hang out with Aaron. He came over to my place. And we talked about quite a bit. And checked out this new album he has called This World of Dew, which I proceeded to screw up the title at least once, maybe twice in the interview. This World of Dew, and it's a duo with Ben Monder, who is amongst guitarists considered in a class of his own, unbelievably free in his concept and transcends his instrument all the time. In fact, in the very first track, I thought it was some kind of like koto or some kind of thing. No, it's guitar. And so they create something really special with their duo, and I was glad to have the chance to hang out with Aaron. And they've got a show coming up this Friday. If you're one of those people who gets the podcast right away, you can check it out July 20th at the Jazz Gallery. And, it should be special. It always is with those two. And, let's check out the opening track called Companion from This World of Dew. And then we'll hang out with Aaron Schrag and check out a little more of the album. All right. Thanks for listening. Peace. Thank you. You are listening to the NYC Radio Live podcast. I'm here with Aaron Schrag. We just listened to the opening track, Companion, on his new album with Ben Maunder, The World is Due.
This world is due. This world of due.
This world of due. Since we're getting off to a goofy start, I'll tell you about my one stage in my relationship with the shakuhachi.
Sure.
Which was my parents had a record called East Meets West, and there was like a shakuhachi player. They had a cassette tape. And when I started discovering some haiku poetry, and I was maybe in seventh or eighth grade, and I decided I was going to go all the way one night and just have my kind of Japanese-themed night. So I was going to go in my basement and read the Zen book or whatever it was and listen to the recording. And then I said, oh, and I'll drink sake. And then I thought, oh, I'll take it to the next level and I'll take a cellophane noodle and I'll put it in the sake. It was some kind of Japanese noodle that we had. And then rice noodle and put it in the sake. And then I lit some candles and I went down and I tried to do this experience and suddenly my back felt hot and I was like, what's going on? And I realized I had my sweatshirt had caught on fire from the candle. And that, I took a break from shakuhachi for years after that.
Well, you probably got a really authentic experience of what it means to be truly in the moment by being on fire. That's an analogy
right.
That's used often in Zen practices, though, putting out a fire on your head.
Wow. All right. I was there before I knew I was there. Wow. I feel so much better about that whole debacle. So actually, the shakuhachi is a fascinating instrument. So, and I once had Kojiro Umezaki. I don't know if you know him. He's in Silk Road Ensemble.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I've met him once, but yes, yeah. I know him.
Lovely
yeah.
guy. So he gave me a little bit of the tutelage and had all these beautiful old recordings. So maybe we could start there. I'm so fascinated. So originally, the instrument wasn't intended to really be played for anybody. Is that kind of correct?
Well, like a lot of things in Japanese culture, it sort of had a migration, you know, through China, and there's a version of the shakuhachi, similar kind of end-blown flute in Korea as well. But in China, it was the shao, and so it was made from further up on the bamboo, and some different, I think there might have been one less holes or one more hole in the shao, and then when it came to Japan, it was made from the root of the bamboo, thicker, kind of huskier sound. And it had a brief stay in the gagaku music, if I'm pronouncing that right, which is the ancient orchestral music in Japan, but then ended up being used mostly, and what it's most well known for is meditation music, which is sui zen, blowing meditation, and was used by Komuso monks in the Edo period. And they would, there was monasteries in which their primary practice or one of their primary practice was to meditate with the flute. And so each monastery would have sort of a characteristic piece or style and a few different pieces. And these pieces were collected by Jin Yodo, around the, I guess it's probably the early 1900s, and there's sort of a lineage of those pieces, and then those pieces have been passed on in different schools since then.
Right, and you can get recordings of Jin Yodo, right?
Yes, I wish I could find it. There's a sort of very, you know, often with these recordings, they're sort of just like field recordings, and it's him playing the entire repertoire. It's really amazing to hear it, for sure.
Yeah. So, and I've also seen pictures of these guys wearing, like, baskets over their heads.
Yes, probably around Jin Yodo's time, that wasn't as popular, but I'm trying to remember the term exactly, but there's a name for these specific baskets. And so they were used for, from what I was told, as so the monks wouldn't compete. They wouldn't know, like, you know, they wouldn't associate somebody's playing with the face of somebody. So they'd like, oh, this amazing player just walked in, and we know we have this expectation. And sort of, it was also meant to suppress their own ego, so that if they're playing for other people, people don't, you know, the person playing doesn't get this sense of praise and acknowledgement. And so it's really about just about the music. On the sort of darker side of that, you know, the legend sort of is that a lot of these monks at a certain point they had free passage between provinces in Japan, and they were used as spies because of that, because they could, you know, hide their identity and move freely. And so there was, you know, corruption within this these monks, and they weren't perfect monks, as Karashi Yodo II would say.
Mm. Well, still, I think it's an interesting contrast to our current model of music making and promotion and stuff, to totally separate the identity of the performer with the music itself.
Yeah, there's I agree. I think there's a lot of really beautiful differences about the music of the Shakuhachi. That one in particular, and then sort of expanding on that also, is that you know, often monks would learn and play only a few pieces their whole life, and you really feel this in the music. There's embellishments, but you know, some of the hardest pieces in the repertoire are often the simplest. And so it's really about what you're bringing to the experience and the meditation aspect of it. So as you were saying, yeah, it really takes that sort of gain aspect of, you know, gaining fame, gaining recognition. It takes all of that away in a really direct way.
All right. Well, let's check out another track from your new album with Ben Maunder, and then we'll discover more about what brought you to this music. What should we listen to?
Maybe something different.
I noticed that, you can do whatever you want, but I noticed Tiny Boat, is that a Jin Yodo? Is that a traditional piece?
No, Tiny Boat is actually part of a larger suite. Maybe if you want to listen to, I guess since we're on the Zen theme, we could listen to, sort of a modern adaptation of that kind of style that I've created on the trumpet, if you want. And that's track 10, inspired by the Bukowski, Charles Bukowski poem of the same name called It's Ours.
Great.
Thank you.
right. We're listening to The World. No. We're listening to This World of Do, the new album from Aaron Schrag and Ben Maunder. And that track is called It's Ours. Wow. So you kind of, to capture this Zen thing, I mean, well, first of all, is that a definable kind of vibe or something like that, or aesthetic? Like what makes something Zen or not?
That's a tricky question for a lot of reasons. I mean, I think a lot of people will associate it or put it in that category. You know, for me, I think it sort of becomes part of my aesthetic from the music that I study and, you know, the meditation practice that I do. But I try to make it unintentional in a sense, you know, and just, you know, I try to let the influence come through without sort of guiding it too much, because I don't want it to become too contrived, I guess. Mm. But because there is, you know, like spas say they're Zen, you know, and there's a lot of culture, sort of popular culture that has sort of taken that. And, you know, I want to keep it real to what my experience of that has actually been and what my actual understanding is, you know.
Right. And it might be one of those things that as soon as you try to do it, you stop doing it or something
yeah,
like that.
That's it. Exactly. Too. Yeah. As soon as, you know, on the theme of like Zen sayings, but, I've heard many people, use this analogy in talks that, you know, when you start talking Zen, you're basically throwing mud on your face, you know,
mm.
So there's, you know, yeah. But I mean, music does a much better job, I think, to capture it maybe than words, a lot of the time.
Yeah. And I feel like something, guitar particularly, is challenging if, and trumpet as well, like to get that. And maybe just certain things about the attack of the instruments and maybe associations with the electric guitar. But I think it, so maybe I'd like to hear a little bit about how, well, one, about Ben Maunder and why he's so special and what he's achieving by being able to get there, but also maybe some of the approaches and challenges that create, you know, this vibe you're going after.
Sure. Yeah. I think I agree that, it's definitely, if I take a step back and start thinking about just the instruments in general, like the trumpet and guitar, you know, they're not the first instruments that you would associate with that kind of aesthetic. But it's sort of the way I've developed playing, and I think also Ben in particular as well. I mean, he has a huge range in terms of what he can do. There was a track that was released on an EP that kind of had like that we did together that almost had like kind of metal vibe with trumpet and shakuhachi, which when we recorded it after, he sort of giggled at the end and was like very un-Zen, you know. You know, I think maybe that's what makes it work a little bit, just that it's not what you would expect. But he has this ability, just sort of this harmonic virtuosity and virtuosity on the guitar, and he has a really good sense of how to use it. So, you know, he doesn't overplay, but at the same time, he doesn't really have limits. So he kind of has this huge range. And he also has this, I think, very refined intuition. When we're in the studio and we were doing retakes, his approach could shift dramatically between takes sometimes, but each one was interesting for a different way. And that was a really great learning experience for me, that he had just this ability to try something different and it would still work. It'd be, you know, yeah.
Wow. And what brought the two of you to start working together?
Sure. It was a little just sort of unplanned, I guess. I mean, a friend of mine, Brandon Bernstein, who I did a record with a little before the first record I did with Ben. We did this, the first record I did of the music of Tom Waits was with him, and he's a really dear and close friend of mine. And he was, I think he was at University of Delaware, but he was doing a degree at the time, and Ben was a visiting artist. Brandon's a guitarist as well. And, you know, they kind of hit it off and had, you know, stayed in touch a little bit. And Brandon, you know, just sort of randomly, I was talking to him on the phone. He's like, oh, you should play with Ben. And I was kind of like, are you effing kidding me? you know, because I would never have really had the, you know, just I would have never have called him. I didn't have his contact. And he's not the kind of person that I would think like, oh, that guy I'm going to play
with.
Right,
he's a real established, yeah. You know.
Exactly. And even within that field, he's sort of one of the, you know, even with among jazz guitarists, he's sort of like put on this other kind of level often. So, but, you know, Brandon just made an introduction. We played, the first gig we did together was at the Village Zendo. And then, you know, I thought it was working well. And so I decided maybe we should do a recording. And that's how the project got started.
Wow, that's amazing. And shakuhachi as well must be challenging. I mean, I know a traditional shakuhachi would probably be pretty tough to be playing in concert with another instrument, right?
Yes. It is done. Yeah, as you mentioned, it's not done that often. There are a lot of difficulties that you face with that. You know, just how the shakuhachi is tuned. You know, it does have enough familiar tuning to work in a Western system, but you do have to be mindful of certain conventional fingerings in shakuhachi repertoire are going to be not work very well. So you have to adapt, and you know, it definitely can work.
And part of your musical DNA kind of is Indian classical as well, right?
Yes, that's correct. I've been fortunate to study with Ustad Mashgour Ali Khan, Indian, North Indian vocals in the Kirana Girana, and then adapt that onto the trumpet, which is the main way I would perform music influenced by that style.
Nice. Is there any kind of Indian influence stuff on this?
Yes, definitely. There's track 3, which is the second movement in this world of Do Sweet, A Tiny Boat, has an influence from Rag Bimpalasi. And then where is it? Old Dust, which is track 10, is influenced by Rag Multani.
Is there something that one of those that we should listen to, or something you feel in something else?
Sure. We could listen to either one. A Tiny Boat.
Cool. I got my Tiny Boat. All right. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Hanging here with Aaron Schrag, listening to his album with Ben Maunder, This World of Do. And that was A Tiny Boat. And that was, which rag was that based on?
It's not completely based in, but influenced by rag Ben Palasi.
Right. Cool. And it's a beautiful sounding album. Where did you make it?
I recorded it. It was recorded by Tarek Khan at the Breeding Ground NYC. He's got a live recording studio where he also does live video performances. That's in Bushwick in Brooklyn.
Nice. And it's Human Resource Records. They have like something particular about them, right?
It's a relatively new record label, started by a friend of mine, Jamie Reynolds, and Eric Foreman. You can find them online. I think the philosophy is sort of in the title a little bit, trying to bring, record labels back to a sense of humanity and, you know, supporting the artists, which is not uncommon for a lot of newer labels these days. But it's been great to work with them, and I'm glad they've taken this project on.
Sweet. And there's a few shows coming up, right?
Yes. The two shows we have coming up on Friday, July 20th, will be at the Jazz Gallery. First set's at 7:30. And I'm going to be inviting some special BRM guests to sit in the second set.
Nice.
And then the next day on July 21st, we'll be in Montreal, Canada. I had to put the in there. I don't know. Actually, I should have put in an A for Canada. We'll be at La Vitrola, which is a wonderful venue sort of in the umbrella of Casa de Popolo. And we'll be sharing the bill with Elwood Epps. Elwood Epps's Togetherness. He's a really great trumpet player, improviser, and a good friend of mine. And we were lucky to produce 3 years of a trumpet festival in Canada together. So that's how we knew each other.
Sweet. Are you? You're not Canadian.
I am. Yeah, I'm a dual citizen.
Okay. Nice. All right. Well, did we do it? Did we miss any important things that people should know
about the record?
About life.
About life. Put out the fire on your head.
Yeah, and actually, you know what? That story you told me between tracks was so good. Maybe you could tell it about the person who wanted to be enlightened.
Oh, so I don't know the exact reference, but from my memory, someone seeking enlightenment was asking this, you know, master in a cave somewhere. And they were insistent that they really wanted to be enlightened. And then, you know, the master was saying, "Are you sure you want this?" And they were like, "Yes, give it to me." You know, and so this huge demon arose from the ground and started chasing them forever, basically, and kept on yelling, "Now, now, now." And that's enlightenment.
All right. So be careful what you wish for, listeners. And thanks for listening. And thanks for hanging out, Aaron. Beautiful record.
Yes. And I guess a shout out, not to forget, very, very grateful to Brooklyn Raga Massive, Trina Basu, making the connection with Jazz Gallery, and really grateful to be here with you, David, and to have this album supported by Brooklyn Raga Massive.
Yeah, our pleasure. All right. Looking forward to the show.
Thank you.
Peace.